Has everyone got a handout? You'll let me know, Media Center, when you want me to begin now. Welcome, everyone, to the August 2008 Learn at Lunch. Back by popular demand, Grace Judson, an executive coach and business consultant, will present The Elephant in the Conference Room, which is about making workplace politics work for you instead of against you. After 25 years in corporate life, Grace Judson ventured out to create Svaha Concepts to help people understand how corporate and academic politics can become an asset to their career. It's such a pleasure to have her back. Please help me in a warm welcome to Grace Judson.
Thank you. The first thing everybody wants to know is, what in the world does Svaha mean? So we'll start with that and answer that question so that you can stop worrying about it and enjoy the rest of the presentation. It is a Native American word that means the time between seeing lightning and hearing thunder. And so although I can never spell my email address over the phone and nobody ever knows how to pronounce it, I think Rose Lee did an amazing job with it, people still refuse to let me change the name because they like what it means so much. They like the concept of any kind of possibility. You know, you don't know what's going to happen. Anything could happen and probably will. So the issue of workplace politics, as Rose Lee said, I have been a long career in the corporate world, came up through actually a technical background. A lot of people who go into executive coaching come through HR or training, but I came through, I was a software engineer back when they still called us programmers, and spent a lot of time also in senior management. And so I've really seen it from the standpoint of many levels of an organization as well as across many sizes of organization. I think probably the most political company I ever worked for was when I was one of just five people. So people often try to tell me that the small ones don't really have politics, and guess what? They do. We're going to talk about a number of things, starting with a little bit of a paradigm reframe over what politics in the workplace really means. But I want to start out by just taking a look at why, you know, you could all be out in the gorgeous San Diego summer sunshine having lunch with a friend or out, you know, on the beach or whatever it might be instead of being here. So I just want to get a couple of ideas from some of you. What intrigued you about this topic? What brought you here today? You don't have to tell me how political your workplace is. Just something that intrigued you about it. Everything. Okay.
The idea about miscommunicating, we do that so frequently, and it leads to such problems, and any kind of helpful input would be appreciated.
Okay. Yeah, and a lot of what politics is about really is about communicating both in terms of what we say as well as in how we understand the broader context of what's going on. Yeah, thank you.
I guess I'm one of those naive ones, and I just kind of figure I'd like to go to work and do my job and go home at the end of the day and not have to deal with office politics. I wish it would just go away.
That's a very, very, I think, you know the old saying, if wishes were horses, we would have so many horses on the planet if that particular wish came true, because I think a lot of people really wish that they didn't have to deal with it.
I'm working in a new setting with different role types than I'm used to working with, and there's just a different level of
So working with at a different level and with different expectations. Okay. I always wish I could write faster at this point. Okay. Somebody else? Anybody? I dried up the available pool of ideas here? Okay. These are good ones. These are really these are great because I think that they're very representative of how a lot of people feel about politics in the workplace. They're representative in the sense of, yes, communication is often, I don't want to say difficult, but challenging within a workplace setting. And the wish to not have to deal with it is really universal. I think a lot of people, even those who are often viewed as the ones who are playing it in the sort of negative sense, often feel that way. So let's take a look at what politics in the workplace really is. My contention is that, I do want to say the handouts here, these are just really visual representations for you to get, maybe laugh a little bit at some of them to get some ideas of what we're talking about. I have a much more extensive handout that I am happy to email to anyone and also provide you access to my newsletter, which has a lot of articles. I put out an article every other week that talks about a lot of aspects of politics, whether it's communication or other types of collaborative behavior. So I'll send a couple of sign-up sheets around for that later. The idea of what politics really is. A lot of people believe that politics exists only in the workplace. It is my contention that interpersonal politics, rather than calling it workplace politics, exists anywhere where there's two or more people communicating. And if anybody is having a hard time really believing that, just think of the last holiday dinner that you had with friends. The reason that politics feels different at work than it does when you're with friends or with your family or wherever outside of work is because at work you are essentially pushed into contact with people that you might not otherwise have chosen to hang out with. If anybody here has ever run a volunteer organization of any sort or worked with a volunteer organization, yeah, you know that the politics in a volunteer organization where people are coming together because they believe in the organization, but again, maybe don't get along with all the people, can be very difficult to manage, even more so than they are in a workplace setting sometimes. When you are with your friends, you choose who you hang out with. If you're involved with a church organization or with a sporting organization, you know, if you play soccer on weekends with your friends, the parents of the kids your kids hang out with, the communities you live in, these all tend to be groups of people where you share a common worldview, a common outlook on life. In the workplace setting, not so much. Necessarily. There are a lot of different people from a lot of different backgrounds, a lot of different age groups. And it's not to say that any of this is bad. This is not a value judgment. It is simply a recognition that in the workplace, you're there with people that may not be people you would choose to hang out with. And on top of that, your livelihood depends on it. You've got to, especially in an economy like we have today, you have to get along with these people. You don't have the option of walking away. I mean, you do. You could find another job. And my general experience is that people spend at least 10 months too long in their jobs. But that's a whole other story. Does this make sense? Do you see what I'm saying here? So when you look at workplace politics as being simply an issue of different points of view, and the political situation is not so much one of outside the office, it doesn't exist, inside the office, it does. It's just a little bit of a different setting. Then we can start to look at some tools that will help you manage that setting better, and it will help you understand what's going on better. It goes back to that larger context that we talked about. However, before that, and since I see that those of you who have brought lunch are no longer munching your way through it, I would like to invite you all to play a little bit of a game with me. It's called the hierarchy game. And we're going to, let's see, we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. I want to split you up, I think, into four groups of roughly equal numbers of people. So if the front half and the two sides would sort of cluster. I know I'm making y'all get up. It's a terrible thing. And what we're going to do, what I'm going to do is I'm going to give each group, everybody in the group gets to pick a playing card. And you're going to not look at the card. Instead, you're going to hold it on your forehead. Yes, I know this looks really stupid. Bear with me. And then what you're going to do is you're going to talk to everybody in your group. The aces are the CEOs. The court cards are the senior management team. And everybody on down from there is, you know, so that when you get down to the twos, you're the, you know, the people staffing the support desk and the, you know, the secretary. Well, the secretaries actually are probably around the nines or tens. And see if you can figure out, just by the ways that people talk to you, where you are in the hierarchy, okay? I'm going to pick, these are already shuffled, so if you just, I'm going to ask Rosalie to handle this group from about here on up, I think. Could I have a couple of you come over? I know I'm making you get up, it's a terrible thing. Who wants to be over here? Would you like to help people pick cards for me? And so that's you on up and a couple people from there. Don't look at your cards, just pick it up and put it on your forehead. Yeah, that's enough from this group. And then can you help me with this group in the back? Oops, there we go. Just fan them out. And I gave them to you backwards. And then you smiled at me, so you get to help with this group. You're a group there. And then just hold them up again so that you can't see them. If you don't want to hold them on your forehead, I won't force you to do that, especially since this is a webcast and everybody out there is watching you. But don't look at them. And talk amongst yourselves. Everybody, you should each... Oh, one thing I forgot to say. I'm sorry. This, you're at a company picnic. So this is a social setting where you're in a group of people so you can talk about the food, you can talk about the weather. Don't look at the card. Let everybody else see it, and so everybody else can see it, but you can't. So hold it up so other people can see it, and talk to each other. I know this is confusing, and that's part of what happens. Talk within the group that you're in. And see, talk individually as if it's a social setting, and see if you can figure out where you are in the hierarchy. So for those of you who are watching this, the object here is for people not to be able to see what they are. But invariably, what happens is that people can, in fact, figure out where they are in the hierarchy just based on the ways that people react to them. So I'm going to give everybody about 5 minutes to have the conversation, and then I will be asking them to order themselves. Can you all make sure that you talk to everybody in your group? Because make sure you talk to everybody within your group. That's okay. Yeah, there are handouts up there on the counter as well.
Thank you.
How other people react to you. Yes, how you interact.
They know what you are.
You, right, because they can see your card.
And if they see an ace, they're like, oh, she's like whatever.
Right, exactly. When they see the higher cards, then they react to that. When they see the low, so you figure out based on it feels very weird in the beginning. The first time I play, I was one of you guys playing it. I was like, what? It's a fun game. People get really confused in the beginning, and then they start to figure out. Give them a few more minutes, and then I will ask them. Yeah, she has a handout. So have you had a chance to talk to everybody? Well, you know what? They could be one group, and you guys could be one group. I think that's kind of how it's worked out here. Okay, how are you all doing? Oh, I like the ones with glasses. That looks good. That's great. Okay, I'm going to give you a couple more minutes to talk. If you don't think you know yet where you fit, you might want to keep talking to different people and see what you get, what kind of responses you get. Okay. Y'all could come back, and what I want you to do now, don't sit down, because what I want you to do now is to, okay, can I get everybody? Within your groups, what I want you to do now is to arrange yourselves in the order that you think the hierarchy is. In line. Still without looking, and you get to look in a minute. So line up with the high end on this end and the low end on this end. High end on my right, low end on my left. High end on this end, low end on this end. Okay, has everybody got themselves pretty much in the order that you think you were? High end on the right, on my right, low end on my left. Y'all there? Yes? Okay. Now you get to look at your cards. Were you right? Were you right? Okay. Pretty, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah. Were you all pretty much right? Okay. If you can hear the sound of my voice, clap. Okay. Now I just want to get some impressions from each group. What was that like? To not really know, but to know what other people were, where other people were. Yeah, how'd you feel, boss? Isn't that interesting how that happened? Yeah.
Right off the bat.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's interesting.
Shelley asked me to do as part of the exercise. She asked me to meet her so I could take notes or give her notes or something later. I wasn't sure where I fell in the food chain, so I wasn't sure if I said, well, maybe I need to check with your boss to see if I should be doing that.
Right, right. So I'm going to try to paraphrase I'm going to try to paraphrase real quick for the people watching who can't. I don't think it picks up on the microphone. What you were saying was that you had been asked by someone to take notes afterwards, and that you weren't really sure how that. There is a very unsettling sort of feeling there where you're not really quite sure, because you don't know where you really are, whether that's really the right thing to do or not, and whether you, yeah. So that's an interesting, yeah. Over here, anybody.
I was gossiping, too, so I thought we were kind of all on the same level.
So the gossip factor, and the fact that you really don't gossip with people that you don't feel like you're on the same level with, yeah. Mm-hmm. And that goes all the way up and down the food chain, too. Trust me on that. Well, actually, when you get to the really high level, the guy at the top has nobody to talk to. I mean, everybody always thinks he's so fortunate because he's making lots of money, and he has nobody to talk to. That's why they hire people like me. Anybody else? Somebody over here. So you, okay, right. You start to help each other out a little bit with this game, don't you? So somebody said that you must be new, so you knew you were probably on the lower end. Yeah. Anybody else?
I kind of picked up that I was at a higher level than a lot of them, so I think some people are voluntary to clean up
after. Oh, nice. Yeah, you were getting that feeling just from the way they were, just from the way they were talking to you. Right. Yeah. So if you all... if you want to sort of recollect the cards, I'll collect them again in a little bit. I just wanted to go through that process because, first off, because it's fun. Once you get over this sort of strange feeling in the beginning, I know the first time I played it, I was like, huh? I have no clue how to figure this out. But it always ends up with people being pretty much right. There may be a few little bits out of whack, but generally it ends up being right. And the point here is that the way we communicate with people based on what we believe their position in the hierarchy is almost instinctive. It's not something that you necessarily really control all that much, because you just do it based on what we're taught from a societal standpoint. Now, there's a whole other set of things that happens. One of the things that I specialize in and that I really love working with is the question of gender differences. And when you throw that into the mix as well, there's a whole other set of things that happen. So when you are looking at how politics plays out in your workplace, just remember this experience and remember that the ways that you approach people are almost, I don't want to say uncontrollable, but very close to being uncontrollable from the standpoint of how we react to authority or to what we perceive as being authority. It's a very interesting thing. So what we're going to do now is look at, there are four key concepts that I teach, and I promise I won't make you get up and walk around again, but I probably will be looking for some comments and questions as we go through. If anybody has any questions at any point, just holler. These are keys that I use in my work with clients. They are the foundation of the workshops that I teach. And they really are some very simple, but not always easy to implement, and surprisingly, I don't want to say profound exactly, because that always makes it sound terribly weighty, but surprisingly effective, let's say, ways of looking at things. The first one, people always look at me and they're like, what do you mean don't argue with reality? I'm not arguing with reality. Anytime you say should, you are arguing with reality. And all of its various relatives. Should, want to, have to, need to. So that when, in the case of my cartoon here, you say it shouldn't rain on my vacation. Of course, here in San Diego, we don't have that problem. But when you say it shouldn't rain on my vacation, you're arguing with reality, because the reality is it is raining. And it doesn't care that you're on vacation. Sorry. When you look at this from the standpoint of people's behavior, I have a client who, when she first started working with me, she was bound and determined that this one person that she had to work very closely with, who was essentially a peer, and they did not report into the same structure, so she had no control over his behavior at all. She was bound and determined that he should behave differently. Now, no argument, this guy was not an easy person to work with. But as long as she believed that he should be doing his job differently, he shouldn't be giving her unsolicited feedback, he should like her, that was a big one for her, he should be answering only the questions in a timely fashion that she asked, then she was going to get stuck in that sort of holding pattern of fighting reality. She called me in tears a couple of times. Why, you know, why does he do this? He shouldn't do this. When she was able to let go of that belief that Mike should do something differently, it became funny, some of his shenanigans. She was able to see options for how to work with what he was doing instead of always believing that it should be something different. And she was able then to make her requests of him in a very straightforward way that asked for exactly what she wanted and didn't leave any of the gates open for him to give her anything else. She gained so much credibility within her peer team. She's a senior vice president in this company. She's on the senior leadership team. She gained so much credibility with the senior leadership team because they could see she was no longer getting emotionally wrapped around the axle of, this guy is not doing what I believe should be reality. And in fact, she gained so much credibility that at the moment she is one of the people, the CEO has recently left, and she's one of the people being considered to replace him. And because they see that she is taking this, I mean, for a lot of other reasons as well, but I personally believe she would not be in the running if she was still stuck in that old pattern of behavior. So does anybody want, and I know it's difficult because many of you all work together and you may not want to mention a specific instance, but if any of you have, does any of you have a question or a comment on this? Can you see how it will work with what your situations are? Right. Expectations and being clear about them, not having them at all, actually falls into the category of one of the other keys. So you are giving me a foretaste of what is to come. Yes, but that, and that is very important. And it's all part of the same thing. These all build on each other. Yeah.
I see part of the overlap of not enabling behavior that shouldn't happen, but partly makes a difference of whether it's that behavior you can do anything about.
Yes, not enabling behavior, and that is actually an interesting point that will come up again as well. And yeah, it's this thing of not being able to do anything about it. But how often does that stop us, right? You know, I can't stop the rain, but I'm going to complain about it, and I'm going to believe it should be different. You know, I can't stop whatever it is, but as long as we are engaged in that battle with what is, then we're going to be less effective, and frankly, we're going to be unhappy. I mean, as long as you are convinced that something should be different than it is, you're not going to be a happy person. Somebody back there had a question.
So I have a question regarding complacency. So you know it's a reality, so you just kind of succumb to it and say, it's reality, so I can't do anything about it, I lose control. So you kind of have this complacency, you don't have the passion or the drive to do something about it.
Everyone, every group I give this presentation to, somebody asks that question. The question was that there is this issue, potential issue of complacency. when you accept that what is the way it is, where is the passion and the drive to change it? It is not a question of suddenly not having preferences. You still have preferences just because what the reality is what it is and you can accept that it is what it is. That doesn't mean that you don't want to move to something else or to change to something that you consider to be better. What it does do is it opens the doors to a wider variety of options, and it frees your energy to be able to because you are no longer trying to make something different right now than it is. I mean, right in this moment, this is what is. When you aren't trying to change that, you are no longer, I'm going to say, wasting energy, resources, your own emotional energy on trying to make it different than it is. Instead, you know, when my client was able to move off that place of Mike should do his job differently, okay, this is how Mike is. Mike ain't gonna change. Maybe he will, maybe he won't, but for right now, he's not gonna change. I can do this, this, and this to work within how Mike is. Instead of continuing to believe and to put my energy towards wishing that Mike was different. So you actually get better results. Does that help? A little? Yeah. Yeah. I was going to say, how'd that work for you? Yeah. Right. Yeah, the question has to do with when it's a small group and one person within that group is whatever they're doing, in this case it's missing deadlines, but whatever it is having an impact on the overall group, how do you handle that? And in the situation, I mean, yes, from a purely logistical standpoint, the impact in a group of one person is directly proportional to the number of people in it. So, yes. It could be easier from an overall perspective to work with somebody who consistently misses deadlines. Somebody consistently missing deadlines or whatever the behavior is within a group, I think you're absolutely right to say that that is a management issue, not a coworker's issue, although there are some conversations that could be had. Without diving too deep into that in this context, if you want to talk afterwards, I'm happy to do so. One of the things about any of this work, working with issues of politics, issues of interpersonal behavior in the workplace, there's no silver bullet. There's no answer that is going to solve all problems. There are situations in every organization where there is an action that maybe would be preferable that isn't being taken for whatever reason. In many cases, when you're working in a small group and there's one person who is affecting the performance of the group overall, it does drag down everybody's morale, everybody's interest in the job, it is not a happy situation. Accepting the reality, you know, this person clearly isn't going to change, and for whatever reason management is not responding to that, that is the reality. Now, how can you for yourself make your own job something that interests you, something that isn't stressing you out because this other person is missing deadlines? And that's where this notion of not fighting the reality comes in, because then you start to look for options. which goes back to what you were saying earlier about, do you get complacent? No, but in a way it actually frees the frustration, because you can start to look at other options. Does that help at all? Anybody else before we go on to the next one? Okay. This is what a couple of you commented on that I was saying, you know, we're going to talk about that in a minute. And the quote here, a good intention clothes itself with power. So what do I mean when I say expect to be surprised? It has to do with going into a situation without setting all the negative expectations and intentions. A lot of people, we are all such good storytellers, aren't we? I mean, you know, the stories you tell yourself about, oh man, you know, it's going to be a terrible commute home, or I've got to talk to so-and-so and it's going to be a confrontation. That's the one I really like, is when you're going into a situation where you know that there's not necessarily a meeting of minds. It goes back to the paradigm shift I talked in the beginning about how when you're dealing with people in the workplace, you're not always going to see eye to eye. I mean, when you're dealing with people anywhere, you're not always going to see eye to eye. And you go into those discussions with all the lists of things of what they're going to say and how it's going to be difficult and how you're uncomfortable with it and how you don't want to do it. And you know what happens? You go in and you go in defensive. And that defensiveness, and we all do it. I mean, I've done it. I've gone into presentations like this thinking, oh God, I didn't get enough sleep last night and I'm going to really screw it up. You go into a situation and the way you behave based on the stories you've told yourself, based on the expectations you've set for yourself, will create behaviors in you that will create behaviors in the other person or the other people. And then you get exactly what you expected, because if you're expecting a confrontation and you go in defensive, they won't necessarily say, wow, why is that person so defensive? But they'll pick up on it, and they'll react to it in kind. Well, if they're defensive, there must be something going on here. Simply by setting an expectation before you go into a situation to be surprised. I give this as homework to my clients sometimes. Follow one unexpected path every day. In fact, I'll challenge you all to do that. It is fun. You never know what you're going to find, what you're going to learn, the new people you'll meet. It's really fun. But when you go into a situation with the expectation of being surprised, it doesn't mean you don't prepare. It doesn't mean you don't know what you want to come out of it. But it means that you then set that aside and I don't know what's going to happen. You go in with curiosity. Curiosity is the most underused tool for having cool things happen in your life. When you set that intention that you're going to be surprised, one of the little rules is that when your behavior changes, the other person's behavior will change as well. That's why they say it takes one to change. Now, you don't necessarily know how the person's behavior is going to change, but in general, I'm assuming that most of us are not working with psychopaths, in general, their behavior will change. I'm seeing a few strange reactions to that. In general, you will find that the other person's behavior changes for the better. My client that I talked about on the last slide, she started to go into situations with Mike expecting different outcomes, and she got them. In fact, he became her new best friend because of the way she shifted in her behavior. So is this making sense? Does this work for y'all? Think you're going to try it? I like it when people try at least one thing. Any questions or thoughts or comments on this one? Give an example of going in with curiosity. Well, again, to go back to my client and Mike, if she would go into a meeting with him without creating the story of what he was going to do or say. He would often come into meetings with her and her team and almost deliberately create trouble. And she would start to approach that with a sense of curiosity about what was behind that. What was his reason for it? And how could she find interesting? And another thing that's really fun to do is when you're stuck on solving a problem, come up with half a dozen totally wacky ways. One of the questions I like to ask is, what would your cat do? Totally wacky ways to solve it. Be curious about how to solve it. And when you break it out like that, you're going to come up with ideas that you're not going to be able to implement. But there's going to be a germ of an idea in there, or there will be an idea in those half a dozen, or the seventh or the eighth that comes up, that you will be able to use, and it will be different. But when you get curious about it, when you start to play with it, become a mad scientist, you never know what's going to happen. It's a lot more fun, too. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Anybody else? I mean, the whole part of this is having fun, right? I mean, if we're not here to have fun, we might as well go play in traffic on the 5. Of course, traffic on the 5 probably wouldn't do us in because it's so slow. But anyway, this one is one of my favorites, if only because of the cartoon that goes with it. I'm often asked when I talk about this one if it wouldn't be better to phrase it as, well, what does somebody really want? What's their goal? And yeah, you want to know that. When we're talking about the larger context and how things appear in the bigger picture, you do want to know what somebody wants. You do want to know what their goal is. But finding the fear is different. Whenever somebody is acting weird, dysfunctional, whatever you want to call it, you can almost guarantee that whether they would admit to it or not, and generally, you know, this includes ourselves in these situations, generally people aren't all that eager to say, oh yes, I'm terrified. So it goes by a lot of names: anxiety, worry, concern. One of the questions I like to ask is, what about this keeps you up at night? Because that's very non-threatening. But whenever somebody is acting in a strange way or in a counterproductive way, you can be certain that fear of some sort is underneath it. I'm not talking about constructive argument. I think that discussion, heated debate, and argument are not encouraged enough between coworkers because everybody's afraid of the confrontation and whatnot. I think you're going to get a lot more out of a much better consensus, a much better understanding of what's going on if you encourage strong discussion. And that's not what I'm talking about here. I'm talking about when somebody is really resisting what's going on. This is probably the one of the four keys that I get the most feedback on, because a lot of times people are like, you know, fear is not something that we want to think about too much. And when I talk about it and then I get feedback from people afterwards that have tried it, they're always like, wow, that really works. It gave me these insights into what other people were doing. Because when you have that insight, you can address it. When you see what somebody is worried, fearful of, concerned about, then you can take steps to do something about it. The bigger context thing. Most of us, if we're lucky, and believe me, there are an awful lot of people who don't have job descriptions, but if we're lucky, we not only have a job description, but we have a good one that actually challenges us a little bit, that really tells us what we're supposed to be doing, what our expectations are. And if we're lucky, we have a manager who makes clear his or her expectations of us as well. And because we know that we are being evaluated and paid based on our ability to satisfy those expectations, we tend to get tunnel vision on them. Here I am, this is my job, and I will do it. we forget to look at how what we're doing affects other people and how what other people are doing affects us. This is part of being able to see that broader context. It's part of being able to look at what is going on around you so that you can not only do your own job, but see, because, I mean, none of us works in a vacuum, right? We all intersect with other people's jobs. So when you can look to see what's bugging somebody, then, as I say, you can do something about it. I'll give you an example from my own corporate experience. I was asked to start a new department doing a fairly new thing for the company without going into a whole lot of details about what it was. And there were a number of people. I was on the senior management team. The CEO had asked me to do this, and there were people who were giving lip service to this, as people in senior management teams often do. Like I said, there is not enough constructive debate going on. But I knew that there was a lot of resistance for a lot of reasons. And I had two ways I could go, basically. I could just say, okay, the CEO has told me to do this, therefore I am going to do it. And be damned to what you think. Or I could have done what I did do, which is I went and talked individually with each of the people involved and found out what was it that was creating that resistance. Resistance is another good word for the fear. And in talking with them about what it was, my result ended up better than it would have been if I had just gone ahead and done what I needed to do, because I was now finding out how to make it really address their needs as well as what I saw the needs being. We were able to put some specific action steps in place and checkpoints in place so that I was able to touch base with them and we were able to measure what it was that they were concerned about. Are you okay with it? This is what we're seeing. Is that okay? Because of that, I not only got their buy-in, but I was able to get the help of key people on their staff, which I had to have or the project would not have succeeded. I have been out of that organization for 5 years now, and I still run into people on the street who are like, oh my God, that project was so cool. We are so glad you did it, because they're still using it. It would not have succeeded if I had not gone through this exercise. So I see nods. I like it when I see nods. Any questions on this one? Comments, thoughts? Can you see, I also see some sort of thoughtful expressions, and I'm hoping that you're looking at how these might apply to some of the situations that you're currently engaged in. Comments, questions? You're a very quiet group. Oh, yeah, sure. The process of looking at what makes a good manager and how managers learn how to become good managers, which is a little bit different from what you've said, but it's a similar, how do people grow and develop in the workplace? And to what extent is it based on training, for instance, versus experience versus mentorship or coaching? Is that kind of the gist of what you were asking?
Or the conflict
and being in the trenches with it and experiencing the conflict is a great teacher if you allow it to be, versus going back to what I said in the beginning, denying the reality of it or believing that the other person was wrong, or all the other ways that people in general don't allow conflict and difficulty to be a teacher. There are a lot of studies done from a lot of different aspects about how people develop through their careers. I mean, from a management perspective, there's the one that Gallup did that I am drawing a complete blank on. But talk to me afterwards, and I can probably get you some references on that, because I read everything, or try to. So, yeah. The interesting thing about management is that people's job satisfaction and their ability to be good at what they do and to be productive in what they do have a lot less to do with the organization they're working for and a lot more to do with the manager that they're working for than people generally admit. I mean, we all know it, but when companies are trying to create corporate culture and that kind of thing, and I mean, I do a lot of work with dysfunctional teams and what's going on there. And it's interesting because, you know, you all know the person you work for. It makes the difference to whether, you know, you have to scrape yourself out of bed in the morning or you at least get up with a smile, if not bounce out of bed. Yeah. So I don't know if that exactly answered your question, but okay. Anybody else with a question or a comment on Find the Fear? And you see why I say it's different from understanding what somebody's goals are. I've had people email me after, in fact, not even a presentation like this, but after just a casual conversation and say, wow, you made me the hero because I was able to look at the situation and it was a conflict and I was able to see what the underdog essentially was afraid of and respond to that in a way that cleared the issue. I mean, didn't make the issue go away, but it clarified for people what was going on and made it possible to move to a resolution. When somebody doesn't appear to have, I mean, everybody's got worries in there somewhere. And if you look at what the specific situation is, and this is one instance where I actually recommend telling stories to yourself very consciously. I mean, before I said, don't tell yourself stories about situations because you end up creating bad effects. There are a lot of other reasons not to tell yourself stories, but in brief. In this situation, put yourself in the other person's shoes. If I were in that person's shoes, what would I be worried about? And then you can kind of test the waters. You know, gee, if I were looking at this situation, I might be concerned about such and so. I don't know if that's come up for you. And there, because there are a lot of ways of saying it. I mean, you don't really want to walk up to somebody and say, I think you're afraid. That generally gets really bad reactions. So you find, you know, like the one I suggested earlier, what keeps you up at night about this? Because that's a very non-threatening way of asking. Or putting yourself in their position. You know, gee, wow, I think if I were in your shoes, I'd be worried about such and so. Is there anything I can do to help with that? Is that... Where does power come in? Yeah, power is a gnarly one, isn't it? Fear exists at all levels. I said earlier that people, the CEO, the guy at the top, guy or the woman at the top, but unfortunately is typically the guy at the top, doesn't have anybody to talk to. And you better believe that he is quaking in his boots, especially if he's in a public company and the board of directors wants to know why the stock price is going down. So in one sense, you could say that it is more difficult, potentially, if you are dealing with somebody who is hierarchically above you from a power standpoint. To address that question of fear. On the other hand, it actually can be very liberating to see what the people who are senior to you might be afraid of. It starts to make some of their behavior not necessarily more tolerable, but more understandable, assuming that there is, you know, negative behavior occurring. And it also starts to help make sense of what they're really asking for. Because when somebody is afraid of something, the things they may be asking for may not seem to really line up with what you think would be the sensible thing to do. But if you look at for what they're worried about or what their concern is, you may be able to figure out what's going on. A lot of this is fuzzy stuff. I mean, there are so many books out there about managing your workplace, about managing communication, and they all give you these tools, right? And they tell you, go forth and use the tools and you will succeed. And the reality is, no one tool works in any one situation, in every situation for every person. That's why a lot of, I call self-help books, shelf help books, because you read them and that's a really good idea and then they land on your shelf. When you look at this stuff from a contextual point of view and from an experiential point of view, using these keys, that's when you can start to see a bigger picture and see what your options are within that picture. Power is an interesting thing because it exists at many different ways and many different levels. And going back to that gender question, women and men handle and respond to power very differently. Yeah. Does that answer your question at least to some extent? Okay. Yeah, like I said, it's all, you know, there is no single answer. And a lot of times the answer is, you know, given a specific situation, there isn't an answer that solves the situation, and that's when you cut your losses and walk out. You know, I mean, that's a reality. I'm not going to say that by using these techniques you're going to be able to solve every problem. You're not. Because not every problem is solvable within the confines of the situation. I'm sorry, did anybody else have any other questions or comments on the last slide? Okay. This one is an interesting one, and it's one that I put last because it builds on the others, and it is also, if you thought the other three were slightly fuzzy, this one gets really fuzzy. There's a very old saying that in any situation there are three truths. There is my truth, there is your truth, and there is the truth. I am not in search of the truth. I'm not sure that there is a the truth. What there is, however, is a common truth that one can hopefully reach where my truth overlaps with yours, and it is usually a stronger place that is going to be more productive. Now, why I say that this one is particularly challenging is because especially when you're down in the middle of it, I often tell my, you know, you've heard the old saying about, this seems to be the section where I trot out old sayings, the old saying about you can't see the forest for the trees. A lot of times when you're in the middle of a situation, it isn't even a question of forests and trees. You're down on the forest floor watching the moss grow. And you can't necessarily see the bigger context easily. That's why it's good to get a second perspective or an outside perspective on it. When you're in a situation that seems like a conflict or seems like two opposing points of view, there is the two opposing truths. And hopefully, there is a place in the middle where those two truths can be reconciled into something that satisfies both parties' needs. Now, this can be tricky to get to because often it doesn't appear as if there really is a common ground. In the situation, I mean, I use a very, very simple situation, which is if you have a case where a manager needs something at the last minute, you don't want to work overtime to produce it. You know, what is the common ground there? How do you work through that? And a lot of times, you know, it builds on these other keys from the standpoint of you look at what the context is. What is the person afraid of when they say, I got to have this? And how can you respond to that fear and still not, you know, miss your kid's soccer game or the wedding you were planning to go to over the weekend or whatever it may be? It gets fuzzy. No argument. Do you see, I know this is where I usually start to see sort of question marks on people's faces. Do you see what I'm getting at, even if you can't see necessarily the direct application of it? Let's start there. Questions about the basic idea of it? Yeah.
This is where the two parties may have different goals there. They have different goals that may be in conflict with each other.
Yes. Yes, the two parties have maybe different interim goals, but yeah, different goals in terms of what they each want. For me, in the situation where I was creating this new department, my goal was obviously for it to be a success. The people who were in resistance to that, their goal was to maintain control of their staff's time and not to yield it up to me, because they felt that giving me any of their people's time was going to be a bad thing for their group. The common ground there was that by showing them how what I was doing enabled their people to be more productive, they could then relinquish, albeit sometimes reluctantly, some of that time. So when you understand, that's why I say this is the one that builds on the other three. When you know how to work the other three, then this one starts to become more clear. When you understand what the fear is, you can then respond to it in a way that creates common ground. Did you have a question? Or? No, okay. Does that clarify? I want to really encourage you. I'm going to send a sign-up sheet around in a minute or two. The handout that I have is 15 or 16 pages. No more cartoons. I'm allergic to PowerPoint bullets, which is why I go with these types of. So I would encourage you to sign up to receive that, and I'll email it to you. And that will help to clarify some of these things further. Questions about this one? Right. The first thing is so resolving the issue of I need to leave, I can't work overtime, somebody needs something. Is there somebody else who can do? I mean, many times when that kind of demand gets dropped on us, and believe me, I've been there plenty of times, the immediate reaction is, no, I can't do that. And wham, the door is slammed closed, and you're just like, so, you know, go back to being willing to be surprised. And look at what the real need is. Do they really need the whole thing? What are they afraid of in not getting it? What are the other options available? You know, can I come in early tomorrow and do it? Maybe that's an option for me. Can somebody else do it? You know, maybe that's not ideal, but it would work. I think one of the really powerful things to remember is that, especially, and again, my apologies to the guys in the room, but there are mostly women here, especially for women, that impulse to always say yes is very strong, because we will always default to maintaining the relationship that's in front of us. It may destroy our relationship with our kids or our partner or whatever else, but at the moment, this is the one that's in front of us. And there's that paycheck thing going on again. So it's recognizing that it's okay to push back and that it's okay to negotiate. You know, okay, what's really going on here? How can we make this work for both of us? I mean, it's such a wide open situation that without having more details about the situation, it's hard to answer more specifically, but does that help?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, sure. Sometimes just being aware of how that kind of, you know, a lot of times we will default to yes, even in situations, and I say this generically, even in situations that are not necessarily a real demand for us to stay late. You know, I need this. Well, nobody ever said when, by when. So you just assume, oh, God, I got to stay and work on this tonight. I'm working with one client right now who defaults to that mode of operation all the time, and I've just asked her to start tracking when she starts leaving and when she actually walks out the door and what's going on in that gap. Sometimes just noticing things like that will make a real shift. Any other questions on this? You're quiet enough that we're actually going to finish a little bit ahead of time, but what I do want to encourage you to do right now is to get together with your neighbors, either in twos or threes, and just let's talk for 5 minutes or so about what of these tools you might actually apply. Create a little plan for yourself, because a lot of times you come to something like this, it's entertaining, I hope I've made you laugh a few times, maybe giving you a few ideas, but when you go back into the day-to-day workplace, it can be very difficult to actually remember and put these into practice. So if you could just talk amongst yourselves for a few moments, and then we'll wrap up with any additional questions that may have come up from that, and I'm going to get the sign-up sheets started going around as well. And when we come back, I'll also ask you to maybe share a couple of the ideas that you have.
They came in late.
They're on the table over there, yeah. So I don't, did...
Oh, for the instructor?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry. Thank you, that was a great presentation.
Good. Thank you. And if you are you interested in getting the extended handout? Yeah, so... You can just put your name and email on there, and I will send it to you. Yeah.
I was wondering what you think about when you have a group that's already sort of agreed to the dysfunction.
Okay. You know what? I'm on mic right now, and it sounds like this is probably.
And you know what, of course, he'll always bounce back as a mirror saying, because this is the way it is, and you can't change this. And I go, yeah, I know that, but I'm just frustrated. And I'm just
There's real freedom in being able to let go of that frustration. It's, to my mind, it's what freedom really means, being able to let go of that need to have things. It's a control issue, too, of course.
Such a close relationship.
That's great. Congratulations.
And I really am. I mean, if I come to the table and little things that bother me, I can just let it go.
It's safe. It's a safety question. And that's a lot of this has to do, again, with the fear. When we talk about finding the fear, it's also about finding your own fear. And I should have mentioned that. It's something for some reason I tend to forget to say, but yeah.
Like I said, I can do it so well.
Yeah, it's a safety question. Yep. Okay, if you can hear the sound of my voice, clap once. If you can hear the sound of my voice, clap twice. Okay, thank you, everybody. Anybody want to share what they're going to do differently from this? Did anybody set a plan for doing something differently from this? Okay, good.
We talked about using the find the fear a little more and basically asking people, you know, what keeps you up at night. And actually one of the questions on our review, self-review that we do when we do our performance evaluations is what needs to be done that worries you. So a similar kind of concept, but that I think, you know, could be helpful.
Yeah.
So trying to be more sensitive to that issue.
So good. Trying to be more sensitive to finding the fear and asking people in that non-threatening way of what it is. Yeah, great. Thank you. Anybody else?
I'm going to work really hard on the first one. I'm not completely stuck on that with one particular person, but I do find myself thinking what you
said. Yeah.
And for me, number three is directly tied to number one.
Good point. Good point. But they're so interrelated. The ways that fighting reality gets tied in with what we're... And I forgot to mention a really key point that when we're talking about finding the fear, it's not just the other person's fear. You get to look at your own first. Sorry, guys, but there it is. You have to look at your own first. What is your fear in this situation? And be honest with yourself. This isn't about running around and telling everybody, you know, what you're afraid of. It's just being honest with yourself so that you can understand how to address your own needs in that situation and make yourself more comfortable within it. Great, thank you. You came up to me in between and with a very good point. That
yeah, and I think that kind of what you were just saying leads to what my question was, is what about when the elephant in the room is what's not being said? And if you're having the same type of meetings all the time and you've got, you know, off conversations outside of,
yeah.
Right.
And okay, just to repeat the question real quick, it is what happens when the things that need to be said aren't being voiced. That, and it goes back to what I said earlier about the constructive debate and how it is generally not engaged in often enough. And how do you start to surface some of those things that aren't said? And yeah, it is, the redundant meetings are a nightmare, and they happen everywhere. Part of the way to address that, quite honestly, is how your meetings are managed and how the outcomes of those meetings are tracked, which is a completely different discussion. I actually teach a meeting management class for the extension here at UCSD. Sometimes when you know something isn't being said, there are ways to ask questions that will encourage people to say it. It's important to understand that usually when something really, really isn't being said, and I was talking to you about this a little bit in between as well, it usually means it's not a safe environment to say things. And when the safety isn't there, you have the option of taking the risk to express some of the stuff that's not being said. But that may not be a wise political decision for yourself. And you are the only one who can answer that. Creating safety is the management role in a group. And it is, you know, as we have so often seen, managers rise to a particular level within the organization, not necessarily based on their ability to manage. People are flung into a management role, often with very little training and understanding of what it means to be a manager. If they're lucky, they have learned from their experience of being managed, if they and the people they manage are lucky. But it's a scary place to be. And it will often create some of that lack of safety for the whole group when a manager isn't secure in his or her own ability to manage. I don't know. I mean, I kind of rambled a bit on that, but I hope that. But yeah, if you can get a group of people together who all recognize that there are things that aren't being said and who are willing to have strength in at least some numbers to raise some of those things, to take that risk, you often find that everybody is very grateful to you, but I certainly will not say that that happens every time. Sometimes you get in, you know, trouble, basically. And the only way you can know, I mean, you can't know, but you can only take your own best estimate of what will happen based on what else is going on the overall group dynamic. Any other questions or comments? To talk about the unsaid things, you can specifically say, you know, I get the sense that there's something not being spoken. Is there some tension around this situation? Some of the same questions I suggested about with Find the Fear. What is there here? You know, if I were in your shoes, I think I might be thinking about gee, did anybody think of, you know, you can also sort of make it slightly flip so that if people just want to laugh about it and not really pay attention, they can. But if somebody's willing to take advantage of the opening, without knowing the specific situation, it's hard to get much more specific than that. But does that give you some, you know, think about different ways that you can come at it sort of obliquely. Sneak up on it. Hey, what's the elephant in the conference room here? Yeah, you know. I do want to say that I'm happy to offer anybody a consultation. It's part of just what I offer to people who participate in groups like this. If you're interested in it, I've got some forms here. You can email me at any time. If you haven't, I don't know where my sign-up sheets have wandered off to. If you haven't had a chance to sign up for the extended handout and my newsletter, which also comes with a workbook called The 5 Deadly Shoulds of Office Politics That Maul, Mangle, and Murder Careers and What to Do About Them. And I can say that in all in one breath only because I practiced. Then I encourage you to sign up for that if you'd like to. And anytime something comes up, I'm happy to answer questions. Pick up the phone, email me, whatever you may want to do. With the, I'm sorry?
Have you authored a book?
I have a couple of books available on the website. The Five Deadly Shoulds is a workbook. It's an electronic workbook that you can download with the newsletter subscription. Yeah, I encourage you all to check out my website. Whether you want to sign up for my newsletter or not, there's a ton of resources there. All my articles for the last 3 years on a lot of different topics. And I also am very excited about a program that I'm launching for women on dealing with gender issues in the workplace. So you can see that on my website as well. It's really cool because they're there. They're there, and nobody talks about them. So thank you.
Before everyone leaves, I'd like to remind those of you who haven't had to leave yet to go back to work, please take a second and fill out the evaluation. I would appreciate that, and so would Grace. Thank you for coming. Let's give Grace a big...
Thank you.
Okay, bye.